session number 24629, reel 5.
Sorry, Lieutenant Commander Collis-RN, reel 5. Lieutenant Commander Collis, reel 6. You're meeting for the
you have several different types of police over there, as you do in other countries. And they have city police, provincial police, and then the RCMP, which is the country's overall police. Now, they say that when you go to a liquor store, you have to go straight home, the shortest route, with any booze on board your car. And it has to be locked in the boot. Well, we used to do this, but we used to divert occasionally and meet other chaps and get it, sorted out. But the laws are different and they're rather strict. I was sitting in the garden. I lived in a house in a place called Manatee, which is on the River Rideau, and just outside Ottawa, where I used to work. And the laws are such that the you can't sit in your own garden and have a beer. You've got to be indoors if you're drinking alcohol. And I was out there one day, sitting in the sunshine with a beer, and I was more engrossed in the chipmunks that used to come and visit me. These chipmunks are a sweet little thing, it's only about so big. And but they were so sort of human in their way. They used to come and have tea with me. And they used to get used to me, and they would get closer and closer every time. And I used to drop the crumbs for them, and they would pick it up and chew it. And sometimes they'd spit it out and say, well, I don't think much of that. What else have you got? But they were fascinating little fellows. And while I was doing this one day, the boat stopped, a little pier I had down the bottom of the garden, and I've got this splendid chap in this scarlet uniform, this RCMP, corporal. Now, I didn't realize at the time, but a corporal in the RCMP has a tremendous power. And he was quite polite and nice and friendly. And he sat down. I was talking about the chipmunks, and the chipmunks scattered off when he arrived. And he said, oh yes, they're very endearing little things. And he said, I said, well, why have you stopped, you see? And he said, well, you're breaking the law. So I said, oh, am I? Huh. And he said, well, you're drinking in your garden. And you're not allowed to drink in there. And I said, oh. And he said, as you're on your own and you are new to this country, please take it as a caution. And we won't do anything further about it. So I said, well, would you like a beer? And he said, well, we'll go inside and we'll have a beer. So we went inside and sat and had a beer with me. And he started chatting about his job and how long he'd been doing it, and so on. And he has the power, if necessary, to stop anything. He can bring a whole airport to a grinding halt if he wants to, just on his say-so. And he has a tremendous amount of power. And they are really highly respected. And the policemen, and the more policemen, the military soldiers, really. And I got to know the head man of the stables at Rockfield. And he took me, I went to lunch with him, and he took me around the stables afterwards. An amazing man. I don't know how many horses there were there, but there must have been getting on for 50, I suppose. He knew every horse. I mean, you know, he called it by its name, and the horse responded. And every horse knew him, quite obviously, by the horse's sort of demeanor and expression. And how he did it, I don't know. And I looked around the stables to see if there was a label stuck up somewhere, which he was reading, you know. But there wasn't. And so it was extraordinary. Anyway, I left Canada and came home, and my last job was in the HMS Warrior. And you know HMS Warrior is now restored in a hulk in Portsmouth, from being a hulk to fully rigged ship. Anyway, she was the first ironclad we ever had. But this Warrior was the shore base of the combined headquarters at near London. And we used to live in a bunker underground in the winter. I arrived there in the dark and came out in the dark, which was, and I was a staff planning officer. And that was quite interesting, but a rather boring job, I found. Trying to persuade countries to build what naval forces they should have in 10 years' time, you know, to make them a viable NATO force. Of course, that's all changed now, because we have so many different nations in the NATO force now. And I then left the Navy and went to sign on the dole. And I went to some friends.
Was it that you'd come to the end of your
naval career?
Service time,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And went to sign on the dole. And naval officers don't retire. They do retire, but it's no hanging from half pay. We're put onto half pay, which is not half pay, it's a pension pay. And it's the Queen writes you a letter saying, thank you very much for your services, but I feel that I can call upon you at any time that I may need to do so. And we said, yes, of course. And so I went to the Dow and said I was ex-naval officer, retired. And he said, where are your discharge papers? So I said, well, we don't get them. So he said, what do you mean you don't get them? He was ex-army. And I said, well, naval officers don't get discharge papers if they're put on behalf of pay. Oh, he said, what do you get then? Oh, I said, I get a letter from the Queen saying that thank you for my services, and she feels that she can call upon me at any time she wishes to do so. And he said, he thought I was pulling his leg. Anyway, he disappeared into the back room to look up the regulations. And he came back and said, you're quite right. You don't get discharge papers. He said, I've never seen a letter from the Queen. Have you got it? So I showed him this letter. He said, it's the first I've ever seen. And I said, yeah. He said, well, he said, you need to go to be on the executive register. And I said, oh, do I? And I said, what does that mean? And he said, well, it means you go to Nottingham and they will interview in Nottingham. Because you've got to have a job of a certain salary to keep you in the manner you've been accustomed to. Oh, I said, yeah. So I went to Nottingham, and a very nice young man who interviewed me. And I said, he said, what job would you like? And I said, well, sea game job, you suit me? Training, I've done quite a bit of training. So I said, how about sea game and training job? So he went to his filing cabinet. He didn't have computers in those days. Pulled out a drawer and went to his filing cabinet and threw his papers and said, pushed out a card. He said, ah, here's the sort of job that would suit you. It's got the right salary, you see. So I said, oh yes, what's the job? He said, oh, head of Nottingham Crematorium. I said, oh. I said, that doesn't sound seagoing to me. And I said, I think they're past training anyway. So we had a slight chuckle about that. And I went away, and 2 days later I got a chip from him in the post saying they're looking for a new master of the Winston Churchill, and so I phoned him up and would I go down to London for an interview the next day. So I went down. There were all kinds of people there who I knew, including an Air Vice Marshal, and he very kindly said, if I'd known you were coming I wouldn't have bothered. So, anyway, I got the job driving that ship.
which I did for 10 years. Very nice.
Great run. You must be bored to tears. You better go home.
That's a three-masted schooner.
Yes,
brigantine?
It's a three-masted topsail schooner. It's got square rigged on the foremast, and all the rest is fore and aft rigged.
What sort of training crew did you have on that?
Well, it belongs to the Sail Training Association, and the idea of this was that you should take to sea a crowd of youngsters, not to train them to be professional seamen, but to give them an experience and a bit of character building, and find out, you know, that what they think might be impossible to do, they can do. And so we used to take them off now to sea. Now, the advantage of going to sea, I used to have 42 youngsters on board. Now, I also had a permanent crew of 5, which was a chief officer, an engineer, a bosun, and a cook, and myself. Okay? Now, the most important chap out of that lot, really, is the cook. Because if you feed people well, they're usually much happier than if they don't get good grub. So that's there. Now, we used to supplement the officers by a second mate, who had to be a professional seagoing man, either Royal Navy, Merchant Navy, to act as second mate, and also a purser and a supernumerary. Now, the purser could be anybody, such as a schoolmaster or somebody like that, who wanted to come, and we also had 3 watch officers. Now, the watch officers could be yachtsmen, you know, who had sailing experience, could recognize lights and things at night, and knew something about the river road. Well, that was fine. Then off we would go for 2 weeks at a time. Now, the advantage, or the great advantage of being in a ship, is that people couldn't walk away from me once we'd upped the anchor and gone. And, you know, they just were stuck with it. So they either liked it or hated it, most likely sometimes. Anyway, we got a few sprinklers of people who hated it. But usually they came round. Some of them were frightened. And the first day on board, they joined on the Sunday afternoon, and the chief officer met them and showed them where they were going to sleep, where to stow their gear, and we had some gear for them to work in, such as working gear. So Winston Churchill jerseys and jeans and things like that. Right. Then he said to them, later on this afternoon, this is Sunday afternoon, you are going to meet the captain. And he'll want to know who you are and ask you some questions. And you will deposit your passport and money with the purser. Okay. We collect the money in because there's nothing worse than a crowd of youngsters living together in confined quarters, having money lying around. It's a temptation for those that haven't got so much to steal, and also a lot of arguments for people gambling and things like that. So we used to take all the money off, the person would keep it, and dole it out when they wanted it to go ashore. And that was fine. Sometimes had never met a chap in naval uniform with 4 stripes on his arm and didn't know who he was or what he was, and so I had to explain that to him. And I said, and you call me sir, you see, or captain. And they took it in. And once we tried an experiment. I said to the chief officer, don't tell them to call you sir or to call me sir, let's see what happens, you see. And it was a complete disaster, because some of them naturally said sir, because they didn't know what else to say. The others who didn't know what to say and didn't think it was, thought it was beneath them to say so, didn't know whether to say you or hey or cat or what, you know. And so it wasn't a great success. And so we eventually said, right, well, the simplest thing is you call me sir, you call the chief officer sir, and if you want to attract my attention or something like that, you can call me captain. So we, that's how we settled it down, and it worked. But the question of calling people by names is quite an interesting point, I think, because in an emergency, it's important that if you want to attract somebody's attention or tell somebody to do something or a crowd of people to do something, you know who you're talking to and they know that you're talking to them. The modern image is we should all be friendly and call each other by their Christian names. You see? But now, if I shouted John in an emergency, about six heads would turn towards me, you know, because there might be six Johns. But if I said Bloggs, there's only one Bloggs. And so I insisted that we always called people by their surname, you see, and not by their Christian name. And I'm sorry to see today they always use Christian names, which I think is a mistake. But however, from purely from a safety point of view, because if you've got to get somebody to, who is frightened and doesn't know what's going on, possibly, to do something in a hurry, it's far better to shout his surname out. Anyway, that's one point. The other point is we never forced people to do things they didn't want to do. For instance, we never force them to climb the rigging. We showed them how, and some were like monkeys and took to it straight away. But those are the people that are the most dangerous, because they're overconfident and they don't know really what they're doing to be able to go at the speed they were going. Those that didn't want to climb, fine, don't climb. But our routine was we sailed on a Monday afternoon, and I used to like to have a gale the first night and on Tuesday, because everybody was seasick, and that's a great leveler. It brings everybody down, and you can then start building up from there. And so, you know, a lot of them were seasick, others weren't, fine. We used to go into a port usually on the third day or fourth day, foreign, if possible, such as if we're in the Channel here, we go to a French port. And while we were in the French port for 24 hours, the little youngster, not so little sometimes, who had said that he didn't want to climb the rigging, asked permission to go up a few rungs so he could take a photograph. Now, we said, fine, yes, you do that. Put a safety harness on, and you can go up as high as you like. You see? And he used to go up about six rattlings up the rigging. Now, the camera was an excuse. He wanted to try climbing the rigging, having seen everybody do it on the trip, you see. So he wanted to try it. And he found it wasn't so bad. He could climb there. Then, possibly, we went to see, and it was a nice calm day or something like that, he would come along and say, could he go up again and try take another photograph? We said, fine. And put a harness on, and we used to keep an eye on him, the person particularly, and he would go higher. And eventually he got to the top. And he was like, you know, as chuffed as anybody could be.
Great sense of achievement.
Yes, great sense of achievement. Today, afraid they tend to hold out carrots, and I don't think holding out carrots to people is a good thing. I think people achieve much more if they do it on their own bat and don't have an incentive to buy the carrot. Because the carrot's not going to be there always, and they've got to do it on their own. And I think you give him far more self-confidence if he does it on his own the first time. And, I mean, so we don't hurry it, but he'll do it, and he'll achieve something, and he's achieved far more than somebody saying, "And if you do that, I'll give you sixpence," you know, or whatever it is these days. It's better that they should do the things on
their own. So you did that for 10 years?
Yes.
And then what did you do after that?
Well, I found that after 10 years, I was cutting corners. And I said, I'm not doing myself any good, I'm not doing them any good, I think I need a change. And so I left the SDA, and I went out far east to do a similar sort of job with the Chinese. And, I found the Chinese interesting. Provided you save face and got a partnership, good. I like the Chinese, and I think the Chinese quite like me. I still hear from some of them that it's no good, especially with the Chinese, I found, bawling them out. You can bore anybody out for doing something, and you're saying you can lose your temper and this, that, and the other, but it doesn't work. And it's far better that to, you know, softly, softly catch a monkey and to take it slowly.
How long were you the Chinese?
I was there 4 years.
So which took you up to when?
Took me up to 83. And then I came home. I was one of the great unemployed, and have been ever since.
So you've had a very long love affair with the sea.
Yes, I suppose so. I enjoy the sea. And these days I look out there and I see it's rough, and I say, oh, well, I can turn over and go to bed. Somebody else can look after that.
So anything else you'd like to say?
Not really, except one thing I will say about the... those ships were built... Winston Churchill was built by a trawler company in Hessel, in the Humber. And she was going to be launched by Princess Marina of Kent. And the weekend before she was due to be launched, there was a gale warning for the Humber area, and the dockies had come and put some extra shores in. Now, the ship was sitting in a cradle on a slipway, and they'd put some extra shores in, and when dockies hammer shores in, I don't know if you've seen them do it, but they get wedges in the bottom, and they bang them in, you know, with hammers, and to make them tight and secure. The Sparlight, who made the masts, had brought the masts and shipped them on the ship, but they hadn't finished the rigging. They put in the lower shrouds, but the upper shrouds they hadn't put in yet, and they said, oh, it'll be all right. But in the gale on the sort of Saturday night, it blew quite hard, about force 8 to 9. And we can only assume this is what happened, because we didn't see it happen. But the wind started the masts vibrating a bit. Now, not being stayed at the top, they were bending and vibrating. Now, that shook the whole ship, just a tremor. And what had happened when they put the extra shores in, they lifted the ship a little. And because of the tremor and the lift, it set the key off, and the ship went down the slipway. Sunday morning, the night watchman came round. He found the ship halfway down the slipway, lying on its side. And the masts, instead of being upright like that, were sort of all like that. It all broken Well, no, it's not broken, but bent at the lower ring. Now, they had to write the thing. There was a hole in the hull. The engine room, one engine was bolted down, the other wasn't. That went flying across the engine room, smashed the other, bolted down one a bit. Anyway, it was all sorted out. But the launching was put off, of course. And Sparlight came to look at the masts, and they said, oh, our masts shouldn't have done that. We obviously didn't make them strong enough. So they made them stronger and better. And I thank God they did. Because subsequently at sea, in a force 11 to 12, I was very pleased that they made those masts stronger. And it was quite a blow. But they're very safe ships. Well, they were. They've gone now. Yeah. And they now have two ex-German trawlers conversions, and square-rigged on them all. That was due to Mike Willoughby. And he was a square-rigged fanatic. Mike Willoughby was a submariner during the war. You've got to be slightly queer to be a submariner anyway. Anyway, you'd better go home.
All right, thank you very much for talking to me. It's been very interesting.
I think it's a bit boring.
Not at all.
Greek, who spoke a bit of English, saying you'd like to see the doctor. I said, what do you want to see the doctor about? Are you ill? And he said, no, not me. He said, a baby over the mountain. So I said, a baby over the mountain? He said, yes. And he said, I said, well, what about transport? How are we going to get over the mountain? Oh, I bought transport and produced two mules. So I went and shook the doctor and said, look, there's apparently a baby is sick, but it's over the mountain. Do you want to go? And the doctor hummed and hawed and looked at me and he said, I suppose I'll have to. And so he said, would you come with me? And I said, yes, I'll come with you. So I got the sub-lieutenant to take charge of the camp and went off with the doctor on these mules. And you ever ridden a mule?
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, right. And you know they don't go very fast if they don't want to. So it took some time to get over this mountain. And we eventually got there. And we arrived there, I suppose, about just after dawn, and we were shown this room, and typical sort of Greek room in the islands. I mean, to say there was a room with a bed and an open window, and no pane of glass in the window, but an open space where you could look out, and hundreds of people. Oh, yes, it seemed like hundreds is when we walked in. But it was all the aunts and uncles, all the relations of this baby. And there was this little baby crying his heart out, red in the face, you see. And so the doctor said, well, I'll examine it. But the first thing is, you've got to get rid of these people. So I said to the Greek who brought us over, I said, everybody out. And of course that was as popular as sort of through everybody. And they didn't want to go, but eventually it got them out. Except the parents. And he examined the baby and he turned to me and said, there's nothing wrong with this baby except it's had too much sun and it's been left in the sun too long. He said, there's nothing I can do about it. I can give it some lotion, calamine lotion to put on its skin, but it's got to be kept in the cool and it'll eventually recover itself. So we explained this to the parents through this chap interpreter of the fellow, and the parents said, no, you must have something, you've got to have medicine. And they said, So I said to the doctor quietly, I said, can't you give him an aspirin or something to give to this child, Got any soluble aspirin? Give him those sort of thing. So he eventually agreed to break some aspirins up and give them a very weak solution of aspirin. And that's what we did. And we left it at that. And fortunately, I heard about 48 hours later the baby fully recovered, you know. But what I'm saying is the attitude of thing, there's a doctor. And of course, they hadn't got any doctor on the island. So go and get the doctor, you know. And so don't go camping in the olive groves at night with a doctor. And then I eventually left Pinchar.